It's a whole different place from the point of view of bhakti. This paradigm, oh, just like the text we had this morning for class, you know. Pashan bandha cha moksha cha. There's bandha. What was it? Moksha? Was that the word? Moksha? And then it said, you know, maya matra. Navastana. Both of them are merely maya navastudaha, without substance, without reality. So here's bandha, here's moksha. The transcendental position is here, and both of them, either enjoying the world or rejecting the world, they both have no reality. So that's basically how I wanted to explain this paradigm. You're going to pass out that paper later, huh? After lunch, he'll pass out this paper about other religions in ISKCON I, so you can see some particular use I've made of this. I must say that there's some research that needs to be done, that I haven't had the time to do it. I would really like to delve into a little more specifically about the karma kanda activities of the Karma Mimamsa school and the Buddhist reaction. You have to get into scholarly historical accounts, of which everything there's at least 200 books and 500 articles to read. But it should be done. Because if when you present wide sweeping generalizations like this, there's some expert who knows everything about the field who'll say, no, 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 no. So one has to anticipate that. Usually what I've found, however, is when you'll find somebody, some materialist scholar has already done your work for you. You just have to find the right guy and who's sort of on your same wavelength, but he doesn't know it. But he's set it all up for you really nicely. And I'd also like to do some research into this Eleatic philosophers, Parmenides and everything, and the criticism of the Homeric gods, which is, again, a karma, jnana kind of a movement. A whole lot of work could be done on the Enlightenment and counter-Enlightenment, as also illustrating this. And just to work out these things in more detail, because I think we can make a very persuasive case for Krishna consciousness. And in this way, do our real job, which is... because Krishna consciousness will not succeed until Mayavad philosophy is people understand that there's an alternative to it. And at this point, no one has gone any higher, because you can't speculate past this point. As soon as you speculate, you just arrive at negation. And that's as far as you can go. So we can't, you know, there's no way you can... I think you can argue like this, that there has to be something higher than negation, that there has to be transcendental name form. I think you can make a rational case. The rational case you can't make is that the form of God is Krishna. He's blue. I mean, why blue? Why not, you know, pink or, you know... Why a peacock feather instead of a pheasant feather, an ostrich feather? You know, these things are known only because God reveals himself and not otherwise. So for that, those things, you can't make a rational argument. But that somebody has to be there, someone who's a person, someone who sustains varieties of relationships, that I think we can make the case. And we can just say, our candidate is Krishna. Now, if you know of anybody better, you let us know. But here's Krishna's biography. This is Srimad Bhagavatam. Go through his biography, and then you give us the biography of somebody greater. But I think on that ground, once they read Srimad Bhagavatam, we'll have them. So, okay, I'll stop here and open for questions. I guess, Maharaj, you're... This one has to... Here's the...
In 2 weeks, I will meet someone who is very in a leading position in the Catholic Church, and he's somewhat of a scholar, a Jesuit. So, in that light, I would need a it would be nice if you could give some more information on this point. You said the intellectual milieu of Christians came from the Greek philosophy. In other words, Greek philosophy and the finding of Greek philosophy were their intellectual tools. And the Greek philosophy arrived at clearly Mayavad conclusions through their speculations. And therefore, because Christianity only had these tools, they have a hard time with bhakti. So can you say what is specific in Greek, what in Christianity, what concepts are borrowed, so to say, from the Greek philosophy? And second, where the bhakti of Christianity is impersonal?
The second part is what you see usually in Christianity is, of course, the object of devotion tends to be Jesus. And because Jesus was on earth, because Jesus had a form, although they think that form was material, still that's worshipped in a personal way. As far as God the Father, of that there's no, seems to be very little personal devotion anywhere. It's hard to speak about Christianity, you know, with a big, hard, gigantic generalizations. But in general, when people become philosophical in Christianity, theologians, they start to think, they always tend to take ultimate resort to this negative theology, to this theology of negation. When they pray, they're in a whole other mood altogether. And there seems to be a lack of integration between their intellectual life and their life of religious feeling. So their life of religious feeling does not get the support intellectually that it ought to. This is a general broad criticism. What else? What was your first question about?
Where do we see the Greek influence Christianity?
But it's there all over. First of all, the early fathers, Origen, Clement of Alexandria, they were Neoplatonists with a vengeance. In fact, the founder of Neoplatonism, the Plotinus, he and the church father named Origen, both were students of somebody in Alexandria called Ammonius Saccas, a mysterious figure who left no writings and is thought by some to have been an Indian. And so you see it right there in Origen. Origen, in fact, taught transmigration of the soul and other things for which later reasons he was declared a heretic when other views became more fashionable. But then, you know, St. Augustine, a big Platonist. In fact, he started out as a Manichaean, believing in two gods, a good God and an evil God. And then he converted to Neoplatonism, which explained how there can be only one principle and that evil is not a positive thing, but just a deficiency of good. And then, from then, he became a Christian. And so the thought that of Augustine was always Platonic. And that was the main Christian philosophy. Then, of course, what happened is through the Arabs, Aristotle became discovered in the 12th century. And that presented a big crisis, was Aristotle. Well, again, Greek. And Thomas Aquinas did the job of trying to weave together the most incredible intellectual feat of all times to take Christianity and Aristotle and somehow fit them together as tightly as he did, you know. So again, that was Greek philosophy. In this case, Aristotelian. But, you know, in modern people, they see Plato as one thing and Aristotle as opposite. But in the Middle Ages, they always thought they were very close. So they had a different idea of even what Aristotle was and who Plato was.
You have given the names,
what are
but are there concepts?
And that will take some time. That will take some time. But, you know, the idea actually of the absolute truth as opposed to the idea of God comes from the Greeks. It comes from Plato. The notion of a one that is the source of everything and that everything emanates from him and comes back to him, that comes from Plato and Neoplatonism. Of course, Christianity rejected this doctrine of emanation for creation ex nihilo. But every account I've seen of creation ex nihilo, when they try to explain it, it sounds just like emanation. So I don't know exactly what that doctrine means anymore. But the notion of the absolute truth, that comes from and Plato, you know, had this notion of the form of the good. You know, there was a realm of the ideas, which were the abstract essences of every particular thing. Man, cow, horse, good, bad, whatever it was, it had its idea. So there's a realm of an ideas. And then in the Republic, he introduces another notion, which is the idea of all ideas, the form of all forms. Adon doesn't mean form like we shape, you know, but just the Adon, the idea of the ideas. The form of all form, the essence of all essences. So you see how you're getting more and more abstract? So this most abstract thing of all. And that was the most real to Plato. And then Timaeus, in a strange way, then this one, because he's not envious, he also expands out into a world. So that's the basic idea that comes from a Platonic notion. So everywhere, you know, the early Christians thought, oh, well, the Greeks, they're all heathens and they worshipped idols and images. But Plato, actually, he saw the truth. We better let some other people ask questions. Yeah.
Prabhu, my question relates to your final remarks about Krishna being blue, having a peacock feather, and also to Xenophanes, who is one of the impersonalists. And it also relates to what we were saying last lecture about Hinduism and not Hinduism, and also to this paradigm you've got here of karma, jnana, and bhakti.
Well, that covers the territory. Yeah.
Xenophanes rejected worship of any deity, saying it was anthropomorphic. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to discuss was what I termed social or national anthropomorphism, in the sense that those who are karmis have no problem in mixing nationalism with religion. Mm-hmm. Like in England, you know, it's very nationalistic.
Well, that's the Church of England.
That's the Church of England, right, exactly. Whereas those who are jnanis emphasize that religion must be non-sectarian.
Yeah.
And we're preaching that we're non-sectarian. Yeah. Now, I'm coming to the point here that many people ask me, your dress is Indian. Mm-hmm. Now, is my dhoti Indian or is it spiritual?
It's, yeah, okay.
that's
let me answer
question.
That question. This is a very interesting question. Because if we're making a claim, of course, is that the dhoti is spiritual, and what's in India is there because it came from something higher and spiritual, and that the dhoti is universal. Doesn't work for winter because winter's unnatural anyway. Human civilization is not supposed to be in these places. But what I argue in this paper that you'll get is when you look at the Mayavada philosophy, which presents itself as that says, this is the platform on which all religions can unite. We can accept all kinds of plurality and diversity. In fact, we don't have to criticize at all. Everything is worshiping God. Whatever it is you're doing, it's okay. Because it says, ultimately, they're all illusions anyway. So, you know, why discriminate among illusions? One illusion is as good as another illusion. this is what they do. So my criticism of that is really, while saying they accept diversity and they accept everyone, really they're wiping everyone out of existence. You know, that's the price you pay for being on this Mayavad platform. And you find out that only one thing is really true, namely the great big nothing, which is, the divine non-existence. So there's a problem with that. So when we come through with our conceptually very specific idea of God, that people will say this is culturally conditioned. And by an argument like this, I think you have to say that here is the level in which you have name and form that's specific and culturally conditioned. And our claim can be here only has to be that what appears to be the particular culture of India is the remnant of a standard normative human culture. I mean, here's an idea that will really blow everybody's mind, that there's a standard normative. You know what I mean by normative? I mean, this is the law for everybody, human culture established by God, which is, in fact, what we believe. And we're all sunk into this idea of cultural relativity. But that's a later development. So the presupposition behind that objection is, in fact, the presupposition of cultural relativity, which we reject. So this will be, of course, regarded as imperialistic, or triumphalistic, as they like to say, Christian triumphalism, we're going to wipe everybody else out and have the cross on every shore and so on, while spreading syphilis and everything among the savages. But what we need to do, I mean, a lot of times your persuasiveness will be by your attitude. You have to be humble and not come up with an attitude that I'm right and you're wrong and all that other stuff. But the other thing is, take this idea. See, here on language. Let's take, here's our language that describes Krishna, right? What we want to say. See, they think that their presupposition, that language is embedded in the material world. It arises out of our transactions with things. And we use it to move things around and to get things done. And that's what it's really for. And then when we start to talk about what's beyond the world, we're stretching our language beyond its proper sphere of usage. We're taking it, and like it's like a rubber band, and we're pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing, and then finally it snaps, And all we can report is at this stage our language is incompetent, right? And the best thing you could say about God or transcendence is keep your mouth shut. Darüber muss man schweigen, So then here we come along, Advaita, Matyuta, Manadi, Mananta, Rupa, Madhyam, Parana, Purusham, Novayo, Vanamta, all these words, describing Krishna like this. And what we say is, this language is different. This language does not arise from the material world. It is not stretched. This language comes from the spiritual platform. It is our language originally is there for glorifying Krishna. And it's misused. When all we use it for is to buy gasoline and so on. Originally it's meant for glorifying Krishna. That's what the real language is. It comes down. So then they'll say, they always want to know about, they always say to me, do you take this literally? I mean, this blue cowherd boy. And here's where I have to say is that actually the literal meaning is there in transcendence. Venum quanantam aravindam dalayataksham. That's literally true. But I have to say that right now with my materially contaminated senses, I do not understand the literal meaning. I really can't tell you what that literal meaning is. When my senses become purified, by, in fact, using that language, then the literal meaning will be revealed to me. This is our philosophy, actually. But meanwhile, the language is valid, and the purifying effect is there, and it's authorized language. What is Krishna's blue like? Well, it's not like the blue of this material world. Well, you use the same word, so there must be some connection. What is that connection? I can't say. But if you also use this language and you purify your senses, you'll also be able to see that blue. You'll also be able to see what that peacock feather is. You'll also be able to understand Krishna's form. So on those charges, I will do a little bit as to say, you know, that when I have a specific idea of God, even though you may think, you may see our pictures, but after all, you know, when Prabhupada, when somebody said to Prabhupada, why doesn't Jagannath look like Krishna? Prabhupada said he doesn't. So the things may appear different in the material world, but actually they're the same, you know, to a spiritual vision. So what Krishna actually looks like, what his form is like, but we know what's authorized. When somebody asked Prabhupada, what does Krishna look like? He pointed to a picture, said, just like that. It doesn't mean like, see, a materialist on the Jnana platform said, well, you start with that picture and then you try to wipe every, you start erasing, you know, to get to the true conception. We don't do that. That picture is a picture of Krishna, but maybe we will not be able to see that picture as it really is until we are very advanced. And then we'll see, what will we see? That picture and Krishna are in fact identical. You know, so now we can have a little agnosticism, if you want, by saying, I don't understand the meaning of those words fully. But you understand the meanings not by getting rid of the words and negating them, but by getting into them further and further and further. That's our process. Okay? Someone else? Yes, Maharaj?
Modern scientists were very powerful, and you've also supported that. And he emphasized he showed us how we could debunk modern scientists by showing how they were not actually coming to the proper assessment of reality. They couldn't deal with consciousness and the explanations of the origin of the universe, etc., were incomplete. So how does this, the Prabhupada's emphasis on that kind of preaching, to establish bhakti, to support bhakti, how does that fit in with this paradigm?
Well, I think when you attack the scientists directly, like Sariputta's doing, you're really attacking this part of the establishment. There's something else going on that's called the new physics, where scientists who are probing the outer edges of the envelope suddenly discover that there are limitations to their knowledge, and they suddenly become attracted to Mayavad philosophy. Schrodinger, you know, started reading the Upanishads. Oppenheimer quoted Bhagavad Gita, in fact, when the atomic bomb went off. And everywhere now there are many, many books coming out. You may have it here, but in America, the Tao of Physics and a whole series of books that they call the New Physics. And it's really what it is people in this karma thing coming to the edge and discovering, trying to make a tradition to Jnana. So here we can deal with that part anyway. But really, for this part to go at this point, what has to be destroyed is the theory of evolution. You know, we'll talk a little bit about that another session. And that's what Sariputta is doing. Right now, the whole everything in the material world, material science, the whole worldview of the people is based right now on the theory of evolution, which is just simply wrong. And when that goes, then the whole consciousness of humanity is up for grabs. And that's what... Because we still have this business going on in the world today, you know, the new physics and the new age movement and the Aquarian conspiracy and all that other stuff. But this is also going on really big too in the form of the institutions of modern science. And they're still, you know, at loggerheads with each other. So both of them really have to be transcended. Prabhu, yeah. Did you have a question, or you wanted to bring this to an end?
It seems, it could be said there aren't any karmis in the world, but to say, talk about karma per se is a little out of context. There aren't any gyanis, real gyanis, because there's no tapasya, there's no austerity happening. And then what about, back to you, because you said, I mean, I found it very interesting, you said identify in your nation, your social setup, karma, jnana, and back where they exist, and then when you identify them, you can see things as they are.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, yes, there's people looking after sense gratification, but not karma. There are people who have impersonalistic philosophies, but it's so speculative. Does, does bhakti, is it existing in our civilization?
Apart from there may be some, you know, little traces of it. What I would like to argue, you see, in the Vedic context, when you actually had, you know, real karmis and real ghanis, also you got bhaktis. Jnanavam mam prapadyate. You know, you had somebody who actually got jnana. Although, even in that context, samahatmasa durlabha, it was rare. But still, it fostered this development. But now what happens is you have failed karma and failed jnana. And really, I argue in this science and religion paper that this failed jnana breeds demonic forms of faith. Because then, from the point of view, you see that the world is an illusion. Everything is an illusion. Everything is a myth. But yet, still, you want to enjoy it. You don't want to renounce the myth. You want to enjoy the myth. And then you get people, you know, then you get, I mean, that starts to become fascist philosophy. You know, that and all kinds of terrible things start to happen when people start to think like that. You become God, and you're actually going to work in this world, you know. I mean, when a genuine Mayavadi thinks he's God, at least he's completely detached. When you get somebody who thinks he's God who's out to enjoy, watch out. Then things really get tough. So, you know, that's a particularly crippled situation in the modern world, because it's all baffled. But still, you know, somehow or other, these things keep trying to come through. Just like we don't have Varnashram Dharma in our society, yet somehow or other there have to be intellectuals, there have to be workers. But it's all done in a weird and confused and disjointed way. So I would say the same thing is happening here. What I argue in the science and religion papers, you really got to have bhakti come in more from the outside. That's Krishna consciousness. It won't arise out of the spiritual condition of the West. Although, where you see a strand of bhakti in Christianity, Judaism, and so on, is because of acts of revelation, which sets it up. Even though it may be overlaid, you know, by so much karma, so much jnana, but there's somewhere an act of revelation, and usually you can see some trace of it there, if nothing else. Okay? He's the moderator, he can hold the mic, huh?
Can. But I just want to follow on from that, because I have noticed in my dialogue with mainly Christians, because that's who I meet most, there is an element of bhakti, there is a religious sentiment, very definite aspiration, but you can see, because they don't have any knowledge, they're not really going anywhere. So I agree that it has to come from the outside to fulfill bhakti, but is it not intelligent for us to home in on what is existent in society and try and fan that?
Well, my position in dealing with Christians is, if you think this is true, go back and look at your own tradition and try to pull out the bhakti and try to develop it. I mean, it was an extraordinary thing for me after I became a devotee to sit down and read the Gospels again. For the first time, I could understand them. I understood what was going on. I understood exactly what Jesus was doing. And I thought, you know, wow, what a bunch of disciples he had. You know, it was really terrible. Nobody understood him. it was that, you know, sudden sense of understanding there. So you can see that's exactly what Jesus was teaching, especially in the fourth gospel. The Gospel of John is a wonderful text. It's really first class. And it'd be hard for anybody who reads that to say that Jesus wasn't teaching a pure devotional service. But whether it was actually understood or by how many people, that's another thing. So they can go do like that. Yeah.